Hello and welcome to this audio CPD module, which is part of the Hear This series created by the Australian College of Pharmacy for the AJP. My name is Dr. Brett McFarlane, and in this series I discuss clinical matters that are important to community pharmacist practice with experts and key opinion leaders in their area. Today I'm talking to accredited pharmacist Debbie Rigby about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and the role of pharmacists in helping people with COPD optimise their therapy. Many of you will already know Debbie from her work with Medication Review, but Debbie also works in general practice. She is an advanced practice pharmacist and conducts education through her company, Pharm Education. The treatment of COPD has really been revolutionised over the last few years, as there are a number of new drugs available and the evidence supporting their use is constantly refreshing. So Debbie and I are going to update you on these new treatment approaches. We're also going to discuss the new inhaler devices on the market and the role of the pharmacist in therapy. And welcome, Debbie.
Hi, Brett.
Thanks very much for speaking to us today. We perhaps should start with a definition or description of COPD. And I think quite often we form a picture in our minds that COPD is just emphysema. And quite often if you're speaking to patients, particularly older people, they'll say to you that their puffer is for their emphysema. But COPD isn't just about that, is it?
That's right, Brett. COPD is a chronic condition. It is progressive. And at this point in time, we really don't have a cure for it. Basically, it limits the airflow in people's lungs. So they have reduced airflow during exhalation and can't completely empty their lungs and therefore have a lot of trouble with just day-to-day exercise, mobility. As you said, people quite often don't know the term COPD. When I'm talking to patients, I've got, and doing home medicine reviews, I've got the list of diagnoses from the GP, and I'll start perhaps by saying, you know, this is for your COPD, and they say, no, I haven't got that.
Yeah.
So they understand the word, as you said, the word either emphysema or chronic bronchitis. So people with chronic bronchitis have a persistent cough and a lot of excessive mucus. And whereas people with emphysema, they've got damaged lung tissues and enlargement of the air sacs and their alveoli. And their lungs are basically quite floppy and less able to move air in and out. So some people will have both conditions. And I think that's important in our discussions with patients, is to ascertain, you know, what does the presenting symptoms, what does the patient feel, and use the language that they're used to.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say it's bronchitis because they know they've got all that excessive mucus, or they know that they're progressively short of breath and have trouble even just walking around the house.
So COPD, or the longer version of that, is probably not the term that you would use in regular parlance with a patient.
It depends on the patient and their health literacy, and I think that's important when we're having discussions, whether it's in the community pharmacy or doing HMRs, that you try to determine their level of health literacy, their understanding of their disease, and use words that they are familiar with. So even just talking about pulmonary disease as opposed to your lungs or your airways, that language is critical for engaging and having the conversation with the patient.
Yeah. So you mentioned that COPD affects people during the everyday. What would happen exactly? Like, give us an example of what would happen to someone during their normal day.
People with the chronic bronchitis type, so there's lots of different phenotypes of COPD, and when we're talking about asthma as well. And I think that's where the big shift in the evidence and the language around respiratory diseases is recognising it's not a homogeneous disease and everybody's the same.
So when you say phenotype, you mean they all have sort of the same underlying pathophysiology, but it presents differently in different people.
Yeah. And you know, some people will have what's called asthma and COPD overlap.
Yeah.
So they may have a degree of irreversibility. Mm-hmm. Basically, we used to sort of differentiate asthma and COPD almost black and white, saying COPD was irreversible airways disease and asthma was reversible airways disease. But people with COPD can have a degree of reversibility. Mm-hmm. It's defined by their FEV1, forced expiratory volume in 1 second, mm-hmm. over the FVC, forced vital capacity, and the sort of diagnostic cutoff point is less than 70% of predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So they may have a degree of reversibility, but their lung function is quite poor, because it is that progressive. Whereas a person with asthma, give them a post-bronchodilator like Ventolin, you can see a significant improvement in their FEV1.
And so they have periods of time in between,
yep.
when they have asthma where they're perfectly fine,
yep.
whereas someone with COPD, not.
Yep. Yeah, they're always at that reduced level of their FEV1.
Yeah.
So people can present just with breathlessness,
mm-hmm.
And part of the classification of the severity of COPD, which then guides the treatment, is are they breathless just on walking?
Yeah.
Is it on exertion? So people with mild COPD, for example, will get short of breath on exertion, so walking to the shops, walking up and down the steps. Whereas people with severe COPD will have a dyspnea with minimal exertion.
Right. So even just getting out just of the bed sitting. Or whatever. Just sitting. Yeah. Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then in Australia we have the COPDX guidelines, and they're classified as mild, moderate and severe. So mild is shortness of breath on exertion. Moderate is shortness of breath just walking on level ground, like around your house or to the letterbox. And severe is dyspnea with minimal exertion.
Yeah.
So, that's breathlessness, but then it's also the cough or sputum production.
Mm-hmm.
People with mild COPD will have little or no sputum, excessive production, and then at the severe end, they'll have regular excessive sputum. They also might complain of chest tightness, wheezing sometimes. We sort of think wheezing is with asthma, but you know, there's obviously bronchoconstriction happening with COPD as well. So patients may have either an audible wheeze or hearing when you use a stethoscope. People will also have reduced exercise tolerance, so their capacity to, they might be okay just walking, but walking around the shops or walking the dog around the block can decline quite significantly.
Okay, yeah.
They might be okay for the first 100 metres, but then they're really short of breath.
And
they will know that.
Yeah.
And that can wax and wane. And that could be an indicator of an exacerbation as well.
Okay, so you talked about exacerbation. Do you want to just walk us through what happens during that process?
Mm-hmm. So the definition of an exacerbation is a change in their normal day-to-day variations in their lung function. And ideally, patients should have a COPD action plan where they, according to their plan, can change their medication. That might be starting oral corticosteroids, a dose of prednisone, a course of prednisone. It may be starting antibiotics, and it may be, obviously increased use of the short-acting bronchodilators like Ventolin. Many older people have poor perception of an exacerbation, and typically will just present to their GP or to A&E, accident and emergency in hospitals, and obviously we want to try to stop that. And part of that reason is every time a patient has an exacerbation, their lung function will decline.
Yeah.
But it won't come back. Once they've recovered from the exacerbation, typically it won't come back to where they were.
Okay.
So you can have this steady decline in your lung function, but if you're having multiple exacerbations, it's going to decline at a much faster rate and then progress to the sort of moderate to severe level of COPD.
So hence the need to prevent exacerbations from occurring.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the core thing, because it's near, we can't cure the condition.
Yeah.
The goals of therapy is very much about quality of life.
Yeah.
But also preventing these exacerbations.
Okay. So as you mentioned just then, COPD is actually a chronic condition and people are living with it for many years. But what does it do to their health in the long term?
It can very much impact on their quality of life.
Yeah.
So their ability just to do day-to-day activities. There's also a lot of evidence around comorbidities, so
yeah,
other conditions associated with COPD, and that ranges from cardiovascular to mental health issues.
Yes.
So people, obviously, if you can't get your breath, can become anxious.
Yeah, it'd be very scary thing, really.
Depression. You know, depression is prevalent with many chronic diseases.
Mm.
Conditions such as osteoporosis, maybe from the corticosteroids they've had over the course of the disease, and a whole range of other comorbidities like even reflux disease, obstructive
mm-hmm.
sleep apnea, and metabolic dysfunction. So the prevalence of type 2 diabetes in
mm-hmm.
people with COPD is quite significant,
mm-hmm.
and that's partly from the use of corticosteroids.
Yeah.
But also, they just, you know, the comorbidities just seem to go together. So that's why it is important to detect COPD early.
Yes.
And I think community pharmacy has a vital role to play in that. People might be asking about smoking cessation support and medicines. It's really scary the number of people that still smoke that have asthma and COPD.
Right.
So we should never assume.
No.
Smoking is the number one cause
COPD.
Asking patients around their pack history, how many cigarettes have you smoked for how many years, is an important part that we can play in that early detection of COPD.
You've given me some statistics about respiratory disease in Australia. I'll just read a couple of them out. 7 million Australians have one or more chronic respiratory conditions, 2.5 million with asthma, 600,000 with COPD. One in seven Australians over the age of 40 years has COPD. Those numbers are staggering, surely.
Yeah. I mean, it just highlights to me, they reckon that one in 20 presentations to a GP is around respiratory conditions, asthma or COPD. And the prevalence increases as you get older. As you said, you know, one in seven people over the age of 40 is pretty scary. It does seem to occur more in males than females.
Uh-huh.
But it'll be interesting to see over the next decade or so. Currently there's a lot of females still smoke.
Yeah.
This older cohort of generation of males, through the wars, etc., you know, they typically did smoke a huge amount. So, you know, one in 20 people seeing a GP, and I don't know the statistics of how many people coming through a pharmacy, but you would think it would be quite similar. So every day we should be seeing patients in pharmacies that that have asthma or COPD, and that's why I think pharmacists really should understand these conditions well and feel confident and competent to have a discussion with the patient.
Absolutely. So we might talk a little bit more about that. What do you see as the pharmacist's role in helping people manage their COPD?
Obviously, you know, they're coming in with scripts for medicines to help manage it, and we need to have a depth of understanding of the drugs, but also the devices. It's also an opportunity to talk about or identify smoking cessation, immunisation. More and more pharmacies are doing immunisation. So people with COPD should have annual flu vaccines as well as their pneumococcal immunisation. It's also those comorbid conditions that I talked about. Some of them are prescription drugs, some are not. You know, the prevalence of osteoporosis, so it's an opportunity to talk to them about their calcium and vitamin D intake, and maybe they need some supplements. You know, reflux disease, you can get over-the-counter PPIs, for example, and antacids. But it's also because cardiovascular disease is a frequent comorbidity, they might be on beta blockers, for example.
Right.
And probably should be for either heart failure or post-MI or even hypertension. So there's been a real shift in the... we used to say that beta blockers were contraindicated in people with respiratory airway disease. The evidence very much says now that for people with COPD, the risk-benefit of beta blockers far outweighs... The benefits far outweigh the risks.
Okay.
So we need to keep up to date with that to reassure patients that the beta blockers for their heart failure or after having a heart attack will reduce you know, the chance of having another heart attack or having heart failure exacerbations. So I think that's another role. Just that reassurance that it's appropriate that they should be on these drugs.
Okay, we'll talk about the drugs probably a little bit later, but I think you mentioned, and I've heard you say this before, that a key part of the pharmacist's role is improving adherence. First of all, let's talk about what's the scope of suboptimal adherence for respiratory illness?
Like any chronic disease, they reckon it's around about 50%.
Okay.
So Australian data, and we've got a lot of Australian data, suggests that patients take between 40 and 50% of the doses prescribed. And adherence rates drop with the number of medications they're taking, whether it's once daily, twice daily administration. So, you know, it's the old saying, drugs don't work in patients that don't take them.
So if someone were using a device that they only had to use once a day, how does poor adherence affect them? Then they just forget to use it that whole day, or they don't want to use it? Or
yeah, I think so. Yeah. And that's where, you know, they might have a dose administration aid for their oral medications and they've got a good routine for taking that. But their puffers and inhalers, you know, usually when I go into people's homes, they're scattered around the house and they don't bring them out with their medicines.
Okay, so they don't see it as a medicine.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it goes back when we're talking about adherence that pharmacists can just really should own adherence. We can have a conversation with the patient when we're dispensing, doing medication reviews or meds checks, but we need to explore and give the patient an opportunity rather than just being the police saying, you know, why aren't you taking your medicines? Explore their beliefs and attitudes and preferences around medicines. So if they understand the benefits of taking their drugs, and this is particularly relevant in any drug that is a for an asymptomatic condition.
Yeah.
You would think with asthma and COPD, they know they're short of breath or coughing up a lot of sputum, but they're very used to just using a short-acting beta agonist like salbutamol or Ventolin because they get immediate relief and just, you know, helps with that breathlessness. But if they can understand that it's an inflammatory disease, that that inflammation and the excessive mucus production is causing progressive damage to their lungs. So there's a sort of framework called the necessity concerns framework. And people weigh up, do I need this drug versus their concerns, either about the side effects or, you know, the steroid phobia, I'm taking these steroids, it's going to break, give me brittle bones or whatever. So we need to explain the why as well as how to take the drugs. So if they have a good understanding of the benefits and the necessity for taking their drugs, and we can put into perspective their concerns.
So they might always have their short-acting beta blocker puffer readily at hand because they know that that makes them feel better when they use it, but not necessarily identify that the other chronic puffer is important for preventing their condition from worsening.
Yep. And that's where it goes back to, we can be the smarty pants expert and go through all the pathophysiology, and I always use a bunch of grapes as my analogy.
So they
can understand that, you know, people, huge range of health literacy, and they don't really understand what their lungs do or what they look like or whatever. But if I explain a bunch of grapes as the, you know, the alveoli, the air sacs, and put it into those words, and if you start breaking down those grapes and have big gaps and holes in their lungs, you're not going to get that transfer of oxygen into the bloodstream happening to the same extent. So whatever sort of picture you can paint for the patient, I think will help, and there's a lot of resources available, help them better understand their condition, feel more empowered to manage that condition, so self-management, and, you know, it's not a magic wand, but that will help improve adherence and persistence to their medicine.
So you mentioned that suboptimal adherence could be caused simply because they forget. It could be because they don't understand the importance of that particular inhaler, for example, in terms of preventing exacerbations. It might be that, because it's a steroid and everyone's scared of steroids at the moment, that they're misinformed about the fact that the benefits of the steroid outweigh the risks in the long term. Is there anything else?
And it's also helping them to understand the teeny doses that are in their inhaled corticosteroids, for example, compared to taking, say, 25 milligrams of prednisone. Yes, there still may be, we know as pharmacists, a small amount of systemic absorption, but trying to reduce the use of oral steroids, which do have, increases your risk of osteoporosis, increases your risk of type 2 diabetes, etc., as well as, you know, changing the look of your face and all the rest of it. So I think you've always got to find the thing that will trigger a person to change their behaviour. So they might not look like the look of, you know, the moon face that you might get from your steroids. Or it puts on weight. Maybe it gives them crazy dreams when they're taking it. So getting them to articulate that, to say that story, And then you can switch it round to say, helping them to understand why taking a preventer, that's its goal, trying to stop you getting to that stage of needing oral corticosteroids for an acute exacerbation. Maybe their goal is to be able to walk the dog around the block every day, and that can be either the trigger to stop smoking or to use their preventers as they're intended.
So I guess it sounds to me that what you're saying, the role of the pharmacist is about education for the patient, helping them understand what the medicines do, why it's important for them to mm-hmm. use them, and then help to address any concerns that they've got
mm-hmm. yep.
over those.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, many people with COPD think they're too far gone.
Okay.
But again, we can help understand, and I use the classic Fletcher and Prato graph. I have that on my iPad. It's available in a lot of the resources, just to show, and even from a smoking cessation
yep.
point of view, they think, oh, yeah, it's too far gone.
Yeah.
But I say it's never too late, because you will see a benefit, a slowing of that deterioration. We shouldn't give unrealistic expectations.
Yeah.
It's not going to reverse their COPD. They suddenly won't be able to run marathons or whatever, but it's slowing that progression. And they've all seen people that are walking around the shops with their oxygen cylinders
yeah.
and or not even being able to get out of the house because they're so short of breath. So reassuring patients that they are likely to see a benefit
mm-hmm.
And a positive impact on their quality of life can help change their behaviour.
Do the scare tactics work, though? Is it worthwhile saying, if you don't do this, then, you know, I can see your future, you'll be stuck at home yeah. on the oxygen bottle and not be able to leave the house?
I think it depends.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you do need to scare people,
yeah.
you know, to realise this is your potential future.
Yeah.
And they, just like teenagers, think it's way too far in the future, you know, giving sort of realistic, approximate time frames.
Mm.
And again, the Fletcher graph is useful for that. But, you know, it varies from patient to patient,
yeah.
obviously, but I think that is. And not, I would only ever get to that point after I've had a really good conversation with the patient. I think that's the beauty of community pharmacy, that these are regular customers. You do get to know them. You can see what they're huffing and puffing when they come into the pharmacy.
Yeah.
Maybe having to sit down straight away, those sort of... In many ways, they're probably a prompt to start the conversation. Oh, I can see, you know, you're really short of breath today.
Yeah, sure.
Are you using your preventers
mm.
Every day? And they might sort of, you know, it's just that opportunistic capacity that community pharmacy has that I think is often underestimated.
I think sometimes as well, with all forms of chronic illness, not everyone has an opportunity to... or even is presented with an opportunity to have someone actually saying to you, how's it all going?
Yeah, yeah. Rather than silly questions like, have you had this before or whatever, you know, that
yeah.
how's it going,
yeah.
you know, is really... And patients appreciate that. Your regular customers appreciate that. And I know when I'm doing home medicine reviews, most of the time I don't know the patient, but... sitting, having that conversation, that chat with them, helps to establish the rapport, and they feel quite relaxed and open talking about the impact of their condition just on their day-to-day living.
That is the end of part one of this podcast. The conversation is continued in part two.